Good morning. Thank you for coming out again today and exploring some of the Bible with me this morning. And as we started out last night talking about what do you think about this book that we have, the Bible? Did it come from man or did it come from God? And we started looking at some things that we have only recently discovered in the realm of science that we're finding within the Bible that goes back, well, it goes back thousands of years, but because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know that our Old Testament came from BC times. We know that those scrolls were the most important archaeological find of our time, certainly. And I made the claim last night that I think even if we found Noah's Ark, that still would not surpass the archaeological discovery of the scrolls. What the scrolls prove is that even to the hardest enemy of the Bible or the church, the scrolls prove that, one, our Old Testament is old. It came from BC times. That's very important as we start spotting these scientific facts that God has sprinkled and buried throughout the Old Testament. And then two, our modern day Bible is exactly what they had in BC times as well. When you look back and you're seeing things like 30 copies of the book of Psalms, I think it was 15 copies of the book of Deuteronomy, multiple copies of the book of Isaiah, and they're all just word for word. Not one bit of meaning was lost in translation from then to our Bible today. That makes the Dead Sea Scrolls very important and shows us where our Old Testament came from, how old it is, and then the fact that as we start uncovering some of these things in the Bible that we have only recently discovered in science, it makes you think, where exactly did this book come from? This book could have been written by the hand of man or the mind of God. And God, Jesus, when you watch Jesus teach, you see he has this way about him of he teaches his message quite often in love and patience, but at the same time, he forces you to make a choice about what he is saying. You cannot remain on the fence as Jesus was preaching and teaching. He forced you to pick a side. And as Christians, as we look at this Bible, I think a lot of the things that we look at today, that we'll be looking at today, a lot of these things that we've seen, it forces us today to pick a side. What do we think about this Bible? What are we going to do about the Bible and the message that is inside the Bible? And so last night we looked at a couple passages that had to do with the first law and second law of thermodynamics. And then we ended on that passage in Psalms that was talking about our sun running a course, our sun moving on a circuit. And for most of mankind's history, we thought that either A, the earth was the center of the universe, the sun moved around us, or then we thought B, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, everything moves around that, and then we all have only recently discovered, oh, actually, we have a galaxy, and the sun does have an orbit. It's just such a massive orbit, and even though it's moving very fast, it takes a long time for the earth, or for the sun, to complete that orbit around the galactic center of our universe. And yet God, in the book of Psalms, set it exactly and accurately according to the reality of our universe. And so this morning, we're going to keep going. Open your Bibles up to Genesis chapter 1. This is absolutely one of my favorite concepts to think about when it comes to scientific concepts or ideas that are in the Bible. And so we're going to read Genesis chapter 1, and we can read quite a few different verses in here talking about the expanse. But let's come down and look at verse 20 to 23. Genesis 1, 20 to 23. Then God said, "Let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens." God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." There was evening, there was morning, a fifth day. So this was day five of creation. And I want to hone in on this word, expanse of the heavens. So the term expanse or firmament, you might have a version that says firmament. It's scattered all over the place in that first chapter. And we'll talk a little bit more about this Sunday morning, and I think our 10:30 session will dig all the way into Genesis chapter 1 and look at that. But I want us to notice this word, expanse of the heavens. Now, the term heaven is used three different ways in the Bible. And it's used in two different ways right here. It's the same root word. It's the same Hebrew word every time. But if we were to look up, and we'll look up Sunday morning, we'll notice this. But it says that God put the stars in the heavens. And it says, well, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So obviously, we're talking about heavens in that sense, in the terms of, hey, we have this huge expanse. It's more than just our universe. It's the entire galaxy. And then we see God use heavens, or this word expanse or firmament, right here in chapter 20, talking about the area where the birds are flying. So we're not talking about space there, are we? We're talking about our atmosphere and that area where birds fly. Now, you'll have to ask God when you see him, "Hey, God, why'd you use the same word for heavens, meaning where the stars are at, and heavens, where the birds are at?" I don't know. I can't answer that question. You'll have to ask him. But the concept is open space, right? So we got a physical open space where the stars are at, a physical open space where the birds are occupying. But you can always tell by the context. Quite simply, you can tell every time which expanse God's talking about as we work down through Genesis chapter 1. But this spot right here, we're clearly talking about the expanse where the birds fly. And remember last night, sometimes I said I'd kind of go crazy over just one word. Well, this one word that we have up on the board here, it's the expanse. The original word was rakia. And that the root word is rakia from that. And what that means is something that is beaten or pounded thin, like metal. It's spread over and it's stretched over. You might use the same word, rakia, if you had a shield and you were covering it with a layer of metal. If you had a wooden shield and you were covering it. So you're beating this metal and you're pounding it thin and you're spreading it out over the shield to create this firm, hard surface. Same concept. Now, so my question always is, when I run into things like this, when you look at our planet and you're going to think about our atmosphere and this expanse where birds fly, how in the world would a man have come up with that word? Why would a man use that word to describe our atmosphere? When you're standing on this planet and you're looking up at the sky, is that something that appears to be pounded, beaten thin, or stretched over the planet. There is not a chance in the world that, standing from this perspective, that a Jewish sheep herder would go, how am I going to describe the sky? I know, beaten, pounded, thin, stretched thin. No way. That is only a perspective of our atmosphere that you could get by looking at the planet from this point of view that we've got on the screen. We describe to children sometimes when we're trying to teach them about sort of the organic or the livable area on our planet as being very thin now. We'll describe it as if you take an apple and you have just the skin on the apple, that's basically where all life takes place on this planet. You've got this huge ball of mass down there, not a lot of life down deep in that, and then you get above that expanse, not a lot of life out there either. We can't find anything anywhere. And yet right there in that incredibly thin layer, there is where God has placed life. But from a man's perspective, does it feel thin? Does it feel, do you duck? Do you feel crowded? Do you feel like, oh, I'm in a tight spot here? No. From our vantage, it's like, wow, how high are those clouds? How far away are some of these things? I mean, you stand there, of course, Moses couldn't watch a jet flying over at 50,000 feet. But you can see, you know, we have Canadian geese. We have marked them at 30,000 feet when they're migrating. So birds can fly up there pretty well. I don't know if Moses ever saw a flock of geese at 30,000 feet. You probably couldn't even see them. But there's no way that human eyes or a human mind would ever describe our atmosphere like this. I've always thought that this word right here in this spot is really, really powerful. And it's great evidence that the Bible is not from the mind of man. And as we move along and progress, you'll see each one of these. I just like to think about it as, in science, as we study things, we tend to stack evidence up. And one fact may not prove the entire argument, but just watch our pile grow as we keep moving. You know, throughout human history, we've had a lot of different ideas about what our planet was, right? We all are pretty familiar with these for so long. Many people thought, the Earth is flat, it's floating around in space. You know, we've seen concepts like this. The old sailors thought, well, if we just keep sailing, we're going to fall off the edge of the Earth. This is one of my favorites. This sort of comes from the Indian religions and their background. They viewed the planet as flat, sitting on the back of four elephants that stood on the back of a giant celestial turtle that swam through the galaxy. That's a good one right there, huh? That's what some ancient civilizations thought. Now, the Greeks, they were pretty close. You know, they had the concept that, hey, our planet is a sphere. And they had this mythological person named Atlas that held it up. So the Greeks were pretty smart. And even Aristotle, you know, he talked about how the surface of the Earth must be rounded somehow, because he even sort of experimented with trying to move to different places throughout Greece, measuring distance between stars. And he actually postulated that the planet was rounded. Then, you know, some civilizations thought that our planet was more like a ziggurat, like it was this type of a pyramid where groups of people just lived all over this giant celestial pyramid that drifted around in space. And of course, Norse mythology, at one point they thought that our planet was just basically one huge mountain There are other renditions that talk about it as being a large tree or something like that. But, you know, we sort of look at these things, and even a junior high, you know, fifth, sixth grade kid would look at this and go, how could people ever believe in these kinds of things? Well, they never had any other perspective of our planet other than standing right here on it. And even if you're out on the open ocean, is it obvious that the Earth has an arc to it? I mean, that thing looks flat, doesn't it? We are so small on this planet that this sphere, almost anywhere we go, appears dead flat. But nowadays, because we have, you know, the pictures of the planet, you know, from space and things like that, they're so common that our children grow up seeing what our planet looks like and where it sits in the galaxy. So this is so nonsensical to us today, but it's only because of technology. It's not that they're dumb and we're smart. It's that we have a different perspective because of technology and advancements than they had back then. And so we totally understand now that our planet is a sphere. And let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 40. And some of these might be very familiar to you. You might know all about these. And we'll go through some of these pretty quick. Isaiah 40:22 says, "It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in." So, of course, we see God describe our planet as a circle. And so even though mankind has gone through all those different renditions of what did our planet look like, how was it shaped, is it shaped like a pyramid, a mountain, a disc, all these things, all the way back in Isaiah. And there's a couple other spots in the Old Testament where God uses the term circle to describe the earth. So again, you see how this all fits together, right? You got mankind that thinks all these different crazy things throughout our history. And then because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know how old these writings are. These are clearly BC writings. And here it is, another fact about our planet that God planted in the Bible. That's exactly right. Just like talking about the sun has a circuit, the planet is a circle. We'll spend a lot of time in the book of Job coming up pretty soon here, but let's turn over to Job chapter 26 and take a look at this one. Job chapter 26, verse 7 through 10. "He stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. He wraps up waters in his clouds, and the cloud does not burst under them. He obscures the face of the moon and spreads his cloud over it. As he inscribes a circle on the surface of the water at the boundary of light and darkness." Again, that one jumps right off the page, doesn't it? How does our planet sit? Is Atlas holding it up? Are four elephants on the back of a turtle holding it up? God hangs the earth on nothing. And there it is in plain English in the book of Job. The book of Job is a tough one for us to mark in time. Some scholars think that the book of Job is probably, it could be the oldest of all the writings, but we're not real sure about where Job sits on the timeline. You can tell from the story of Job, and we'll take a little deeper look at that pretty soon, but you can tell, you know, that Job lived in a patriarchal time. He was back there during the time of Abraham and Moses for certain. Now, whether he was before, in between those two men, we really don't know. But it's pretty interesting. So God hangs the earth on nothing and says right there, the circle of the earth, just like he said in Isaiah. Now, let's see, turn over to, there's a couple places. Let's turn to Amos chapter 9. So again, this is something today, you could see up on the screen, this is something today that I think we really take for granted. You could see, I mean, this is clearly a picture of the water cycle, isn't it? And here in California, we have a really great setup where we have the ocean, then we've got, you know, a little bit of a mountain range, and then the Central Valley, and then we've got a pretty high mountain range. All very close together. You can drive from one to the other in just a few hours. And so we actually can see water coming off the ocean in the form of storms, hitting those mountains, being pushed up. And as a cloud is pushed up in elevation, the temperature goes down. And as the temperature goes down, as they're going up in elevation, the cloud has the ability to hold less moisture. And so as a cloud is pushed up in elevation by the mountains, they're quite literally wrung out. And they can't hold that moisture anymore. And so that's why we get more rain at higher elevations than we do at lower elevations. It's pretty simple to us today. We understand that rain comes off the ocean, hits the mountains, falls, forms rivers. It all flows back into the ocean. And we've got this cycle. We call it the water cycle. Again, something that we teach to children, maybe as early as fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. And yet, how long has this been known about by mankind? It's not an obvious cycle in most places on the planet. And it really wasn't until, I think, about 1936 when it was really mapped out and started to be put into textbooks and taught on a regular basis like this. I know for us today, that's kind of hard to believe. You're like, wait a minute, Steve, in 1920, 1890, they didn't understand this? Not entirely. Did we know that storms came off the ocean? Yeah. Did we know that rain fell in the mountains and flew back? Yeah. We understood that. But we didn't understand in total how this works in some of these systems. And for us, we live in a spot where we have quite a cold ocean. And so that cold ocean, you ever jump in the beach at Morro Bay or Monterey, you know, wow, that's cold. And that cold ocean does not lend itself to as much evaporation as, say, the Atlantic Ocean around Florida. Around Florida, the currents are pushing that up from the equator, so that ocean is quite warm over there. That's why they're getting thunderstorms every day, like clockwork. That water is evaporating off of that warmer ocean at a very high rate compared to the Pacific. It's not evaporating at a high rate. That's why we struggle with water. That's why Scott thanks the Lord for rain, because we have a hard time finding it around here sometimes. But again, another concept that we take for granted, and yet it's buried all over the place in the Bible. And what do you think ancient man knew about this? I think about the Egyptians. So they're sitting there on the Nile, and the Nile is actually fed by rainfall from mountains, I think like 900 miles away in Africa. They can't readily see that concept taking place there. If you lived in Mesopotamia, you had the Tigris and the Euphrates River moving 1,000 miles, and you've got storms depositing rainfall all the way up in the mountains of Turkey up there. And that water is being dropped and then transported in many cases hundreds, if not 1,000 miles, to people in Mesopotamia. So it's not, we've got this really short, quick, easy thing that we can see right here. But let's take a look at Amos chapter 9, verse 6. And God says in the book of Amos, "The one who builds his upper chambers in the heavens and has found his vaulted dome over the earth. He who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth, the Lord is his name. So think about that line. He who calls the waters from the seas. Is that something that you can you walk out on the beach and just sit there on the ocean and go, look at that water going up in those clouds? That is not something that you can readily witness and see. That is something that you've got to really look at. You need some technology to be able to study that, to understand how that works. Let's go. There's three references here. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 13 real quick. Jeremiah 10, verse 13. When he utters his voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and he causes the clouds to ascend from the ends of the earth and to make lightning for the rain and to bring out the wind from his storehouses. So that term right there causes the clouds to ascend. Your version might say vapor to ascend. Can you see vapor ascending out on the ocean? You can see vapor ascending if you're boiling water on a hot pot, can't you? You see steam come up. You ever seen that out on the ocean? Well, the Bible says, hey, vapors are coming up off the ocean, forming clouds and depositing rain. How would a man see that? 200, 300, 2000 BC. Where's that coming from? Now, here's my favorite one, though. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 55. This is actually the spot where years ago I first spotted this. And Isaiah chapter 55, right around verse 10, God is actually talking about his word and what his word does. And God, through Isaiah, is saying, hey, I am going to do some things. I am going to work. I am going to send out my word across mankind. And it's going to produce something. When I talk, some people are going to listen and act. And in the process of teaching about the power of his word, God uses this analogy right here. So this is a spot where God's not even meaning to talk about science. He's talking about the power of his word. And yet he uses a scientific fact to say something and to prove something. So I have just 10. I'm going to start reading in verse 8. Verse 8 says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so will my word be which goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it. So God's talking about his word, but look at the analogy that he uses and look at this phrase. Let's see, where is it? Verse 10, for as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth. So the Bible just said that rain's going to come down on the earth and then that rain is going to go back into the heaven. Sound like the water cycle, doesn't it? A perfect description of the water cycle. How could a man know that? Why would you sit on this earth and have rain falling on your head and think to yourself, well, someday this rain falling on my head is going to return to heaven? That wouldn't make any sense from a man's point of view. And yet, God states it like that. And quite possibly, sometimes, not necessarily in this instance, but there are places in the Bible where God will make a statement about the natural world. And the enemies of the Bible will ridicule that. Look at that. That's ridiculous. Look at what the Bible states. It's ridiculous. I could imagine at some point somebody reading that going, rain fall down, it's going to go back to heaven. That's ridiculous. How does that work? Well, enough time and enough technology and enough study take place, we discover some things through science and we realize, the Bible was right all along. And those are the kinds of things that we're just going to see over and over again. This is one of my favorite passages right here because of how descriptive it is about the water cycle, how exact, and the statement that it makes, it would just seems impossible from a man's point of view. It seems unlikely, unnoticeable, really, from a man's point of view. Okay, now, many of you may know about this one, too. I think this one is very interesting as well. Turn over to Psalms chapter 8. Psalms chapter 8, we'll start reading in verse 3. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God, and you crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep, oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heaven, and the fish of the seas, whatever passes through the paths of the seas. O Lord our God, how majestic is your name on all the earth. So now this concept of, in verse 8, paths in the seas. So just think about that one for a second. What exactly is a path? I'm sure that when I say the word path, you think of something in the mountains, like a trail or something like that. Like it's pretty wild on both sides, but okay, here's a spot where I can get into and easily move from one place to the next. And God said, there are paths in the sea. Now, was God talking about ocean currents? I don't know for sure. But I do know that this very passage is how ocean currents were discovered. There was, we had a guy in the Navy who read this years and years ago. And paths in the sea. And they went out and started studying. And that's actually when ocean currents were mapped out globally for the first time. And so certainly back in the days of Paul, you could read various accounts of when Paul sailing from one area to the other. You know, they knew to sling underneath islands or to do different things. We've had mankind's been navigating the oceans for a long time, and some of the things that they have figured out were really incredible. They were good figuring these things out. They understood that, hey, ships, if you want to go from here to there, you get on this side of that island and you're going to go that way. You get on the wrong side of that island and it's like you're kind of fighting against everything. And they had all kinds of crazy thoughts and ideas about what exactly they were fighting against. But I think they had some general concept of ocean currents, perhaps, but certainly nothing that was mapped out to the extent that we have got them mapped out to today. And so, if you've seen Dora, is that the name of that movie? Finding Dora? Is that right about the fish? Dory. Okay, Finding Dory. Like that's got to be, for kids, that's got to be the most famous reference to an ocean current of all time, right? If you haven't seen that movie, go ahead and go watch it. It's real cute. And the turtles jump into an ocean current. Boom! And they just take off. Looks like they're moving at the speed of light. Then they jump out of the current and they slow down. Then they jump back in it. It's not quite like that, but that certainly gets the concept across to the child's mind of how ocean currents work. And there are some ocean currents around the planet that are really strong. Some strong enough that you can't really swim against them. They're going to move you from here to there, no matter how much you try to stay in one spot. And so, anyways, I just have always thought this is a very interesting spot in the Bible where God talks about a path is almost a route of easier accessibility, a route of movement. That's really what a path is. And God calls it out. There's paths in the sea. Turns out, yep, there's ocean currents all over the place. So I've got here just sort of a summary of some of the things that we have looked at over the past couple of nights. And I like to put them up on the board in this kind of form sometimes, just to remind us about, I just like to stack them up. And like you look at paths in the sea and you go, oh, Steve, what does that prove? Really? It doesn't prove anything. No, I'm not saying it does. It doesn't prove that the Bible's from God. But it is evidence, isn't it? That, hey, something is going on here. What is the deal? And when you start stacking all these things up, like things about the laws of first and second laws of thermodynamics, you got Genesis 1:22 is talking about Rakia. You got Psalms 8, paths in the sea. Job 26, God hangs the earth on nothing. Psalms 19, the sun has an orbit. Isaiah chapter 40, the earth is a circle. Jeremiah 10, talking about vapor ascending to the heavens and forming clouds. To me, that is a very strong one, just like Rakia is. Isaiah 55, describing the water cycle. Amos, where God says he calls waters from the sea and he pours them on the lands. It's exactly scientifically accurate. It's exactly right. Now, there's one at the bottom there that, turn over to Leviticus chapter 11 real quick. And we'll just read it very quickly. And Leviticus chapter 11. And let me find, I think we want to start in verse 13. Yeah. Now, I kind of geek out on this, again, wildlife biologist, when I see things like this, I hone right in on it. And verse 13 says, "These, moreover, you shall detest among the birds. They are abhorrent, not to be eaten. The eagle and the vulture and the buzzard and the kite and the falcon and its kind, every raven and its kind, and the ostrich and the owl and the seagull and the hawk and its kind, and the little owl and the cormorant and the great owl and the white owl and the pelican and the carrion vulture and the stork and the heron and its kind, the hopi and the bat." God gives a list of birds that he tells the children of Israel, don't kill and eat that one. Now, why did he do that? Did they just taste bad? And of course, you might be thinking, Steve, why is the bat in there? Bat's not a bird. Well, remember, and we'll talk more about this when we get to probably Genesis chapter 1. God does not name animals the same way we name animals. We have this binomial nomenclature. We have our own classification system. We built it. We did it. We say, oh, mammal, warm-blooded, has hair, feeds its young, mammary glands, things like that. Marsupial, oh, does some of these things, got a pouch, right? We classify fish and eels and all these different things. Is God beholding to our classification system? No. So I've always found it comical that God looks at the bat and he goes, yeah, it's a bird. It's got wings that flies around. What's wrong with you people? And by the way, he says, don't eat it. All these other animals in here, don't eat it. The buzzard, the stork, all these different things. The vast majority of these animals right here are what we call case strategists in the wildlife realm, meaning they're slow reproducers. They're not rapid reproducers. And so this list of birds is still a list of birds that we would protect today because they don't have the reproductive capability to withstand the pressures of hunting and feeding on them. Now, some of them might hurt you. If you go and you eat a buzzard or something like that, who knows what he just ate? So that might hurt you too. But most of the animals in this list, this is really quite a perfect list of conservation of species. You notice quail's not in there. Quail is a rapid reproducer. One pair of quail can have a clutch of 12 to 15 eggs. And if conditions are right, they can double clutch in one season. And I have even seen them triple clutch in wet years when you have moisture into the summertime. So you can have two quail, producing 12 times 3, 15 times 3 in 1 year. It's pretty common for them to double clutch. And so quail and a lot of birds like that, we call them, they're very explosive. They can be very eruptive reproducers. God says, hey, go ahead and eat those. That's who he fed the children of Israel with, wasn't it? Eruptive reproducers, fast reproducers. So I love it. It's like, well, that's some pretty good conservation right there. Same list of birds that we have off limits to us today. Well, anyways, I think my time is up for right now. We'll pick up and start, I believe, in the book of Job in our next session here in about 15 minutes or so.